Today is Thursday, August 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Hurricane Laura made landfall early Thursday on the southern U.S. Gulf Coast, leaving hundreds of thousands without power. Plus, the Republicans continued making their case for President Trump.
But as President Trump said, where Joe Biden sees American darkness, we see American greatness.
And the sentence in 2019's mosque shooting has been handed down. We'll have these stories and more next. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Laura has officially made landfall in the southeastern state of Louisiana after a long journey through the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico. Forecasters say Laura touched down early Thursday morning in the coastal town of Cameron, Louisiana. The NHC says the storm hit with a maximum sustained wind of 195 kilometers per hour, making it a Category 3 storm on the five-level scale that measures a hurricane's potential destructiveness. It has since weakened slightly to a Category 2 storm. More than 390,000 homes and businesses were without power in both Texas and Louisiana. Officials now say search and rescue missions will begin as soon as conditions allow, along with damage assessment. Laura killed 24 people in the Dominican Republic and Haiti when it struck there as a tropical storm earlier in the week. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence accepted the nomination for a second term in office as Republicans met for a third day in a mostly virtual national convention. Michael Sullivan reports that in the midst of civil unrest in many American cities, Pence offered an upbeat message and warnings about his Democratic Party opponents.
Pence spoke from Fort McHenry in Baltimore, the symbolically important site of a celebrated 1814 battle.
So with gratitude for the confidence President Donald Trump has placed in me, the support of our Republican Party, and the grace of God, I humbly accept your nomination to run and serve as Vice President of the United States.
There were statements of patriotism and support for frontline officers facing sometimes violent protesters, angry over the deaths of several black Americans during encounters with police.
The violence is rampant. There's looting, chaos, destruction.
A theme repeated through the evening.
I'm talking about the heroes of our law enforcement and armed services. Leftists try to turn them into villains.
The targets of criticism, Democratic Party nominees Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. A veteran policeman says Trump is looking for solutions.
President Trump supports the creation of a national standard for training on de-escalation and communication to give officers more tools to resolve conflict without violence.
Biden has said he does not support demands for police defunding, but wants more funds for community policing and mental health workers.
I don't want to defund police departments. I think they need more help. They need more assistance. We have to make it clear that this is about protecting neighborhoods, protecting people.
Military veterans who support Trump told their stories. Chinese dissident Chen Guangcheng accused Biden of appeasing the Chinese Communist Party. There was a Trump family member, as on previous evenings during the convention, this time Trump's daughter-in-law Lara, and Pence's wife, schoolteacher Karen Pence. Mike Pence said Republicans have a message of hope.
Joe Biden said that we were living through a season of darkness. But as President Trump said, where Joe Biden sees American darkness, we see American greatness.
Trump will take center stage on Thursday for the final night of the Republican convention. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
So what exactly does President Trump need to do tonight when he formally accepts that Republican Party nomination as its candidate for president in the 2020 election? And how can he close the polling gap with his Democratic rival? Now, to get some insight on that issue, I spoke earlier with Craig Albert, a political science professor at Augusta University in the U.S. state of Georgia.
Well, I think there's two things. One, I think tonight needs to follow Tuesday's narrative, which was appealing to the independent or the reluctant Trump voter. So I think Monday and Wednesday were much more of the Trump base, the Republican base, and Tuesday appealed to that more independent or middle-minded voter. And I think today really needs to reach out again to them, because those are the ones that are going to determine this election. The base is already locked up. That far right of the Republican Party is going to vote for Trump regardless of what he does. So I think he needs to do that. And the way I think that he's planning on doing that, and this is a continuation of how the convention has gone so far, is to paint Vice President Biden as the leader of the progressive part of the Democratic Party. And so obviously he's not. He's much more centrist. If he does that, that might help his chances. But we'll see. I think it might be more of an entertaining spectacle than anything transparently related to policy or to appeal to the independent voter.
Speaking of policy, this national convention for the Republicans did not set out an official platform aside from supporting President Trump in getting a second term. You know, elections for the nation's highest office is often about, you know, what can that candidate do? With the Democrats having an established platform, does this hurt the Republicans?
I think so. And as much as the Republicans like to say that the Democrats don't have a platform because they're just anti-Trump, it seems that the Trump campaign has the same approach, if that's a fair understanding of the Democratic approach. They're running as just not progressive. And so they're not putting forward any policies or implications of what the policies are. And really, they're not running on President Trump's last 4 years. He has one of the most executive orders a president has done, one of the most administrative policies presidents we've seen. So he could list out and really go into detail as to all the policies, whether one likes them or not. He just has a lot of them. So he could go and run on his policies that he has been able to get through, which would benefit him with the establishment Republicans and with his base. But it doesn't seem like he wants to bring up his last 4 years. He's just running as an anti-progressive and really stoking the base. But I'm not sure that type of stoking is what you need in the racial climate that we have right now, especially with everything that's continuing to happen this week. So I think he should tout more his policies and his executive orders, even though that tends to be against conservatives. They seem to have forgotten that point right now during the Trump presidency. But I think that's what he would need to do if he wanted to close that gap a little bit. And one thing about polling, we should be cautious about that, because this is something that hurt the Democrats in 2016. The more a distance between Biden and Trump, the more likely is people on the left won't come out to vote because they think it's a shoo-in already.
Craig Albert is a political science professor teaching at Augusta University. Now, despite claims by President Trump, senior intelligence officials told reporters on Wednesday that there is no information to support allegations that a foreign government will use mail-in ballots to manipulate the outcome of the upcoming election. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden has more.
The briefing that they gave on Wednesday was the latest in a series of information they put out. And one of the questions that came up was about the mail-in voting, about the mail-in ballots, and the concerns that have been raised consistently, repeatedly by President Trump and some administration officials going back to May about how foreign adversaries or even the Democrats were trying to use mail-in ballots to rig the election. And what senior intelligence officials said was blatantly no information or intelligence to suggest that's happening. There's no information about nation state actors. So we're talking about countries like Russia, China, Iran, which intelligence officials look at as the big three who have the potential to really try to impact an election. Nothing to suggest they're targeting mail-in balloting. And a senior FBI official says that they haven't seen anything either in terms of any domestic coordinated fraud effort to impact the election. So they shot that down. There are, though, still other concerns they have about election security, including worries about disinformation campaigns that are being waged actively by Russia, China, and Iran, and also by potential attacks on networks and computer systems that are going to be used in the election process, whether to tabulate the votes or just see who's on the voter roll. And another senior FBI official said, and I'm going to quote here, "The American public should rest assured that it is very difficult for a foreign adversary adversary to meddle with actual vote counts. And this is something that intelligence and law enforcement officials and election security officials have been saying repeatedly going back to 2017 when the reports came out about what happened with the 2016 presidential election. The intelligence community came out and said the Russians meddled. But what did that mean? The big concern in 2016 was that the influence campaigns, the way that the Russians and perhaps others were using social media, Twitter, Facebook, other ways that people have of communicating to put out certain messages that might influence the way a person voted. There was evidence in 2016 that the Russians did scan and in some cases did penetrate state election voter roll databases and some other systems, but there's no indication that anything was changed. Looking over the last 4 years, a lot of effort has been put into shoring up and safeguarding those systems. And as a result, they say it'll be very difficult for anybody to penetrate those systems and to change the actual vote tallies.
That was Jeff Selden, VOA's national security correspondent. And coming up later,
Brenton Tarrant is the first person in New Zealand's history to be jailed with no prospect of parole.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to a recent count by NASA, there are about 4,200 confirmed exoplanets and nearly 5,500 candidate exoplanets that await confirmation. To confirm exoplanets, astronomers must spot their proposed exoplanet with another detection method or with telescopes other than the one they originally used. The astronomers then must write a paper on their findings and submit it for peer review by a recognized scientific journal. Once the findings are peer-reviewed and published, the exoplanet is considered to be confirmed. For the first time, scientists at the UK's University of Warwick used a form of artificial intelligence called machine learning to confirm 50 new exoplanets. The machine learning technique they used employs an algorithm they designed that distinguishes signs of real planets from false sightings. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. According to a recent study by the U.S. Institute of Peace, the so-called Islamic State militant group, which was driven out of its strongholds in Syria and Iraq over a year ago, is determined to regain territory in Iraq. During his recent talks in Washington, Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi discussed security challenges facing his country with President Trump, who told them U.S. forces would soon leave Iraq. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi talked with Ismail al-Sudani, the former Iraqi military attaché in Washington, about the capabilities of Iraqi forces and the steps taken to enhance capacity building.
The American and the coalition forces are effectively contributing to elevate and raise the combat readiness in Iraqi security forces in different areas and fields. So it is incomplete right now, and because the units are missing many fundamental elements to reach that required level to deter any threat, such as reliable intelligence, logistic, air support, and so on. The other part of the answer is the political dispute among political factions, which has reflected on the command and control relation over the security forces. Some influential political parties are still on their armed groups and do not want to abandon the forces and would like to them to be part of Iraqi security forces at the same time. So this is odd situation has created, and then may created also a gap that would be utilized by the ISIS to infiltrate and execute their attacks. So the question is, are Iraqi political factions or rivals would be accepting to build the Iraqi security forces without any political intervention, without armed groups are part of the state, but at the same time, they are practicing their operation out of the state manner.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi has assigned the sensitive interior and defense ministries to independent officials not under the influence of pro-Iranian militias. What do you make of that?
This is very encouraging and inspiring, in fact. The designation of professional officials in sensitive security appointments are a good step in the right direction to build real democracy, real institution, not belong to any political party. That is very important to build the cabinet capabilities of Iraqi security forces. This will lead to enforce law and order and stabilize the situation. It will allow the judiciary system to practice its rule effectively without any pressures. Still, the political system in Iraq has been designed to comply with an ethnic sectarian quota. On the other hand, the officials who do not have a political backup in the parliament would experience some political irritation or discredit from political rivals. Therefore, the path to establish the rule of law and state institutions in Iraq is full of challenges and requires enormous sacrifices.
Al-Kazimi also made the intelligence agencies, the army, and the counterterrorism agency accountable to him personally. Would that enable him of controlling the security situation and confront attempts to destabilize Iraq?
The armed forces, in order to accomplish their missions and tasks effectively, require firm command and control to manage and ensure the employment of troops, fire, air, and logistic support. Hence, Iraq is facing a critical challenge to control over the unruly and out-of-state control groups that threaten peace and security. These groups are politically supported and are not part of the Iraqi security forces, or they are pretending to be part of the security forces, attacking the Iraqi bases that hosting the U.S. and coalition personnel. The tribal clashes are another form of threat to social peace and security. So whatever Mr. Al-Kazimi do to centralize the command and control will enhance the security, will keep every element under the control. So security will be affected accordingly.
Ismail al-Sudani is a former Iraqi military attaché in Washington. He was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. Afghanistan's top negotiator said Thursday that peace talks between the government and the Taliban will begin in September. It's a crucial diplomatic process needed to end two decades of war in Afghanistan. Abdullah Abdullah, a prominent politician and the chairman of the High Council for National Reconciliation, said that Afghan officials were ready to hold the talks. U.S. President Donald Trump's team has been pushing both sides to resolve differences and sit across the negotiation table, paving the way to end America's longest war. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg met German Chancellor Angela Merkel Thursday to discuss the most pressing diplomatic issues requiring cooperation between allied nations. Stoltenberg said NATO was watching developments in Belarus closely following weeks of demonstrations challenging the re-election of the country's longtime president, and said that NATO supported a sovereign and independent Belarus. Russian President Vladimir Putin says his Belarusian counterpart has asked him to provide security assistance to help stabilize the situation in the country if needed, adding that there is no such need yet. A court in New Zealand has sentenced a man who killed 51 Muslim worshippers at two mosques to life in prison without parole. Brenton Tarrant, a 29-year-old Australian, admitted to carrying out the attacks in the city of Christchurch in March of 2019. Phil Mercer reports a judge said that his actions were inhuman.
Brenton Tarrant is the first person in New Zealand's history to be jailed with no prospect of parole. He had admitted to the murder of 51 people, 40 counts of attempted murder and a terrorism offence. But Judge Cameron Mander said despite his guilty pleas, he appeared neither contrite nor ashamed. The sentencing hearing in Christchurch began Monday. For 3 days, Tarrant showed little emotion as almost 90 people, survivors of his atrocity and relatives of the victims, confronted him as they told the court the impact his crimes have had. Some were defiant, directly accusing the shooter of being a coward, while some were forgiving. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has refused to utter the perpetrator's name and says he deserves to die in prison.
My expectation is that our corrections service does their job and that is ultimately keeping this individual in prison for the rest of his natural days. And the other job that we have is making sure that he has no notoriety, that he has no platform, and that we have no cause to think about him, to see him, or to hear from him again.
The attack in March 2019 was in part live-streamed by the gunman. The self-confessed white supremacist had carefully chosen his targets, two mosques in Christchurch. The court was told Tarrant's planning was meticulous, and he attacked at a time when he knew the mosques would be busy at Friday prayers. He would later describe to the police non-European immigrants as invaders. He was heavily armed and went in ruthless pursuit of his victims. The youngest was a boy of three who died clutching his father's leg. The massacre sent ripples of grief far beyond New Zealand. Other victims came from around the world, including Syria, Afghanistan, India and Turkey. The crime shocked the world, and New Zealand responded with stricter gun laws. In a statement read out this week in court, Sarah Kasem, the daughter of one of Tarrant's victims, asked if her murdered father was in pain, if he was frightened, and what his final thoughts were. The life sentence has been greeted with relief by the Muslim community, although a spokesperson in Christchurch said the attacks had exposed the fault lines of hate that still exist in society. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com on your phone, on your tablet, or any other electronic device. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Iran's stated determination to expand its nuclear program, its launch of ballistic missiles, its continuing support for terrorist proxies and the murderous regime of Bashar al-Assad, and its reported negotiations with its totalitarian ally China to forge a 25-year strategic partnership have raised alarms around the world. But what also must be remembered in the list of concerns over the Iranian regime's malign activities is the suffering the government is inflicting on the Iranian people. The New York-based Center for Human Rights in Iran reported recently that prominent women's and student rights activist Bohareh Hedayat has been sentenced to 4 years and 8 months in prison. She was charged with the spurious crimes of assembly and collusion against national security and propaganda against the state after participating in a peaceful protest in Tehran following the downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, in January 2020. In a tweet, Ms. Hedayat compared the deaths of the 176 people killed in the crash to the hundreds of Iranians killed by state security forces when anti-government protests broke out throughout the country in November 2019. Ms. Hedayat, who has already spent more than 6 years in prison for peaceful civil rights activities, is not alone in facing punishment by the regime for protesting the downing of the Ukrainian aircraft, a tragedy for which no one has been held criminally responsible. Dozens of other Iranians have also received prison sentences and, in some cases, lashes for daring to raise their voices against the role played by the IRGC in the tragedy. The United States has not forgotten the suffering of the Iranian people, including Bohareh Hedayat and other protesters, as they attempt to exercise their fundamental human rights. The United States continues to call out the regime on its rights violations. It continues to sanction government officials, including ministers, judges, law enforcement, and military leaders who repress dissent. And it continues its campaign of maximum pressure to deprive the regime of resources to pursue its malevolent behavior outside and inside Iran. As Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said, we make it clear that the world is watching. And as the regime continues to make its own people the longest suffering victims, we will not stand silent. The United States will support the long-ignored voice of the Iranian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.